Welcome to the Med Device Cyber Podcast, the podcast that dives into the critical world of medical device cybersecurity. I'm your host, Christian Espinoza, joined by my colleague, Trevor Slattery. Each week, we explore the latest trends, share expert insights, and discuss real-life stories that highlight the importance of protecting the devices we trust with our health. Whether you're a manufacturer, regulatory affairs professional, or a concerned loved one, this podcast is for you. Let's get started. Hi, welcome back to the Med Device Cyber Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Espinoza. I'm here with Trevor Slattery. And today we're going to talk about post-market management and anomalies that we might find in a medical device. We talked about pre-market before, but the challenge is what happens after the device is on the market? How do we make sure it stays secure? And if a vulnerability is found, how does somebody, a manufacturer, update that vulnerability? So this is a very critical topic. And before we dive into it, I just want to introduce myself a little bit. I'm Christian. I'm the founder of Blue Goat Cyber. I'll let Trevor introduce himself.
Hi, I'm Trevor. I'm the CTO and director of MedTech Security at Blue Goat Cyber. And all right. Yeah, so how's your day going today, Christian?
My day is packed. You know, I've got all these days. It's like block after block after block of stuff to do. I wanted to go karting today because I signed up for this endurance karting event. And I want to get into like a 24-hour one, but I just haven't had time. So my endurance is probably not that great.
So 24 hours of nonstop karting.
Yeah. You need a team, but yeah.
Oh, okay.
You kart, you do a pit stop. You have to do pit stops to change the tires. And yeah, I should probably start with like, the one I'm going to do it in this month is 2.5 hours. But I want to gradually work up to 24 hours.
Yeah, that'd be a lot. I think about, you know, if I've been up for 12 hours and I'm driving, I'm already getting tired. If I'm up for 24 hours and I'm driving, I shouldn't be driving.
Well, that's the challenge, right?
Yeah.
All right. So we've been talking so far about in our previous episodes about pre-market, which is all the things we need to do for a medical device before it gets on the market. And now we're focused on post-market. Because once the device is on the market, we still have to be concerned about vulnerabilities because a new vulnerability might be discovered in Bluetooth and in a third-party library. And how do we handle all that is really the topic of today's discussion. So, and when we say pre-market, like I said, it's before the device is on the market, post-market, it's on the market. So a couple of the main areas for post-market, and I'll just go over these, and if I missed any, you can fill it in, Trevor, is what's called a coordinated vulnerability disclosure system. So that's one of the requirements for post-market. The software bill materials management is another requirement. So if a vulnerability pops up with a third-party library, annual penetration testing at least once a year, and vulnerability testing, as well as static application security testing. And then one of the challenges, I think, with post-market is if a vulnerability is discovered, how does the manufacturer securely develop a patch for it and then deploy that patch? Because not every device, the patch can be deployed over the air or OTA, some people like to say. Sometimes it has to be deployed by a field technician that physically goes out there and plugs in a USB drive. And then the scenario that always goes through my head is, what if that USB drive is infected? Now you're just making the problem worse, right? So they have to have a total product lifecycle that is very secure. Did I miss anything, like any of the requirements? And we can dive a little bit deeper in each of them.
Yeah, I think that's a great overview of everything. And of course, every device is going to have a little bit of a different threat landscape, and as a result, different post-market requirements. But in short, the main things that need to be covered is continued security through the supply chain, continued security through the public, which is where that vulnerability disclosure system comes into play, and then finding a way to fix things as they come up. So an interesting area that I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on, and I know the FDA has been pushing away from this. They've been pushing away from devices that can't receive updates. It's a bit of a double-edged sword, as update functionality is a new attack vector. But if you're unable to update a device, it can be a very involved process to make changes. So I'm curious on your thoughts on how to manage devices that are unable to receive updates once they're out in the field?
Yeah, I've got quite a bit of experience with that. We've dealt with devices for, I've been doing this for a little over 10 years now. And devices that can't receive an OTA or over-the-air update are oftentimes more secure because, like you alluded to, that pathway to allow a remote update can be exploited. And we've had clients that have not secured that pathway or that environment. So it opens up a can of worms, though, because you have to send somebody to the device, or you have to train the physician, the user of the device, the doctor, the nurse, whoever, on how to do the update and mail them a thumb drive or something. So it's important to have a mechanism in place if your device can't be updated over the air and make sure that mechanism is secure. So if I am to put something on a thumb drive, like a firmware update, and provide the instructions to a field technician, I have to make sure that that thumb drive is not compromised. And there's been lots of scenarios where people have bought thumb drives at trade shows, they've received them, and they've all had malicious code on them, right? So we have to have a way to ensure the security of our update process to fix the vulnerability, because it is another pathway to introduce another vulnerability.
It's like that one scene from Mr. Robot where the guy on the street is giving out USB drives with his mixtape on it and then compromises a bunch of people's computers.
Are you a Mr. Robot fan?
I personally didn't like the show that much, but I feel like I'm obligated as a penetration tester to watch it.
I watched one episode, and because all the penetration testers kept talking about it so much, I felt like it was like too mandatory to watch. So I only watched one episode. But maybe I'll go back and watch it, because I felt left out of the conversations when they're all talking about Mr. Robot, you know.
I don't think it's worth watching. But anytime I introduce myself to someone, I say, yeah, I do offensive cybersecurity. The first question is, have you seen Mr. Robot? Every time.
Well, I do sales too, and the first question is not always, have you seen Glengarry Glen Ross?
Yeah, I think Mad Men's a whole lot better.
I haven't seen that yet. Maybe let's check it out. All right, so what the over-the-air update, let's go back to that. We talked about sending a field technician. The over-the-air update, which the FDA is pushing for, that's what you said earlier, that opens up a whole nother attack vector. Based on our experience with clients, we've had clients that don't have a separate network to push the updates to their devices that are deployed. They've had the corporate network, and somebody that's attached to the corporate network is pushing a device or an update to the device. And that's a problem because there's no segmentation on the corporate network typically. So if the HR person's computer is infected because they clicked on a phishing email, that computer can infect the computer that's pushing the update to the device. And now there's a mechanism to actually infect all the devices remotely. Have you seen that before?
Yeah, that can definitely be a problem. And using medical devices as an entry point into compromising a full hospital network is very, very common. It's a very common vector for threat actors. The Internet of Things is notoriously insecure. I know a lot of our better hospital hacks at Blue Goat have been through insecured X-ray machines and printers. It's very easy to move through them. So,
you know, I have a it's maybe a pet peeve of mine, but I've never understood why people say insecure versus unsecure when talking about devices and cybersecurity. It's not like the device doesn't feel good about itself. That's insecure.
So it should be unsecure?
Yes.
I'm not sure unsecure is a word.
Well, maybe that's the problem. We make up words in cybersecurity all the time, though. So
Yeah. Well, you know, one way or another, maybe we can make it a word, if nothing else.
All right.
Well, insecure or unsecure, whichever they may be, devices are one of them in a lot of cases. So we need to have a way to protect networks from medical devices, interestingly enough. In that perfect example, if a device is connected to a network, you can use it to move through the network. So there is an increased level of risk there. outside of using the device as an entry point, the device is a lot more visible if it's on the network. So we'll assume that a threat actor has found a way to compromise the external hospital network and move their way to the inside. If this is a remote threat actor and this is not an internet connected medical device, they're not going to see it. And so they're not going to know its potential for attack. If it is connected to that internal hospital network, even if it's the internal network, they'll still be able to see it and potentially target and attack that device. So there's a lot that can go into protecting a device. And unfortunately, update functionality usually does require that to be connected to the network, an over-the-air update functionality. There are some workarounds for it, like using Bluetooth for the update functionality. This is common for a lot of smaller or lower energy devices. But if done properly, if done securely, if the update server is secure and rigorously tested, if the device is secure and rigorously tested, over-the-air updates allow for very quick deployment of fixes, very quick changes in the event of a problem, and more managed deployment across multiple devices. So it is a bit of a double-edged sword, though.
Yeah, as you're discussing that, something came to mind that is a challenge I've run into because we've worked with healthcare providers or healthcare delivery organizations, as well as medical device manufacturers. And one of the challenges that an HDO or, you know, a healthcare delivery organization, a clinic or a hospital face is, from their IT department perspective, is they have all these devices on their environment that they cannot patch or update themselves. And it's a source of frustration. So imagine you're the IT department for a hospital and you have 200 medical devices on your environment that you do not know if they have a vulnerability or not. And if they do, you can't patch it. You're relying on the manufacturer to patch it by sending a field technician or doing an over-the-air update. It's a little bit frustrating scenario.
A really interesting statistic that I like to bring up is this statistic from 2023. This is an estimation from the FBI. They believe that over 50% of medical devices had a known critical vulnerability in 2023. So it's scary not knowing if yours is one of them and having it out on that network. And I think that's why guidance is changing so quickly. And the FDA is pushing out such a drive for cybersecurity in medical devices, as you don't know what you don't know. And now with a lot more intention and focus behind it, modern devices aren't going to have that problem as much.
Yeah. And that ties into, you know, network segmentation for medical devices away from typical systems on the, like the systems, the EMR or the systems the nurses use on the hospital. So let's dive into the specifics for post-market. We talked about a CVD, a coordinated vulnerability disclosure system. You want to explain a little bit about what that is and why we need one of those?
So a CVD is a method for a manufacturer, a company, a network, whatever it may be, to bring in information about a device from the public from a security perspective. The coordinated vulnerability disclosure, a public security researcher is going to disclose that vulnerability, and then the program will be managed by the manufacturer or by a third party. If the manufacturer is having Blue Goat handle their CVD, then we're the ones managing this vulnerability intake, and we interface with the security researcher, and then we interface with the manufacturer, kind of as a middleman to determine what's actually a substantial report. It is a great way for someone who finds a problem to just come forward responsibly and say, hey, I found this issue, you should be aware. Now, one big issue with doing this typically is hacking is illegal. So a coordinated vulnerability disclosure is essentially giving legal protection to a security researcher to say, hey, we aren't going to pursue action against you. Maybe we'll even send you a branded t-shirt, you know, something just as a thank you for doing this. But we want to know what problems could be in our device. So it's a great way just to bring in information from a lot of different perspectives. It's not always going to be accurate information. Sometimes people can submit a report where they don't really know what's going on. They aren't, you know, getting accurate information out, but more often than not, it's security researchers with the best intention trying to just help spread security and make the world a bit of a safer place.
Yeah. So what it looks like in deployment, I guess, is if I'm a security researcher, or I don't even have to be a security researcher, I could be a nurse or a doctor and just discover something. I go to a website, I put in the device, I put in what I discovered, how I discovered it, my contact information I want to. And then if it comes to us on the back end, we run that to ground and just determine if it's a true positive or a false positive. And if it's a true positive, like it actually is a vulnerability, we will then work with a manufacturer to fix that vulnerability. And then that takes us back to the scenario, how do we deploy that fix to the device?
Definitely. And having that full process going through, working with the whoever disclosed the finding it's really important. So the communication aspect of a coordinated vulnerability disclosure program is often very overlooked. Sometimes the more focus is on just the outcome. If there aren't the available means for a security researcher to convey this information, or they aren't sure how to convey what they've found, then it's going to be very hard for the manufacturer to fix it. So having a good process in place for interfacing with researchers, doctors, nurses, whoever finds the problem, and then having a good way to get all the information necessary and then convey the fixes from whoever's triaging the finding back to the manufacturer, this three-step chain is really important to keep everything moving smooth. So that's definitely part of the post-market management, but the list kind of continues on with another very key component being supply chain security. So why don't you get a little bit into what is important for considering supply chain security with the post-market?
Well, supply chain security comes into monitoring that software bill of materials. And this is a sticky topic for a lot of manufacturers. They don't want to make this SBOM, the software bill of materials, public, because they think it's like a playbook to how to break into their system. But, you know, if I'm buying a vehicle, I think I have the right to know who makes the brakes, or who made the distributor, or who makes what spark plugs are in it, which is like the bill of materials for the vehicle. So I don't think it's necessarily like releasing all the vulnerabilities, but that's one of the requirements, is to monitor the software bill of materials, which is all the software components that were borrowed from other places, typically open source, that go into the manufacturer's product. Because one of those libraries that were borrowed could have a vulnerability, just like Bash was used in a lot of devices in the past, and the Bash shell had a vulnerability, but nobody knew which products had that third-party library in it. And when that's the problem we're trying to solve. So that was really, when Shellshock came out, that was really a major issue. And people are like, I don't know if our device has that library in it. And then their device became infected.
There was a pretty similar issue recently. I'm not sure if you remember. I believe it was this March or April. There was a problem with the XZ library on Ubuntu machines. And there was this big panic in the cybersecurity community that every Ubuntu machine had been backdoored by an insecure component, that somebody built a fake library into the library. So it was essentially a transitive dependency, and that left a backdoor in, it was estimated around 1 billion machines because of how prevalent Ubuntu is. I remember at the time getting a call from, right when the notification came out, I was in Korea at the time, so I was asleep, and I got a call from someone on our team at like 3 a.m. saying, hey, you need to wake up. We have to fix all of our machines. We have to figure out which ones are using this library. Turns out we didn't use any Ubuntu machines at all, so it didn't matter for us. But it was still definitely a little bit of a panic day in the security industry.
Yeah, we like to have panic days. People always talk about burnout and all the stress in cybersecurity, and we can never sleep because attackers are always attacking from around the world.
Yeah, it's a 24/7 hands-on job for sure.
Got to have your go bag ready in case you have to respond to something, you know. what does it actually look like when we talk about SBOM management? like, how do we do that for our clients? And what would you say are the best practices?
So when we're looking at an SBOM, we first need to find everything that's in the product. That can either be a long, horrible manual process, or you can use tooling to do so. There are a lot of different tools for that available. We use Fossa as kind of our preferred tool. We see really great success with that tool, and it seems to dig a little bit deeper than some of the alternatives.
Fossa, they also have the output specific for what the FDA is looking for, right?
Yeah, it's built right into the NTIA standards, which is the expected format for an SBOM that the FDA wants to see. So they have a little box you tick on their platform, and it generates everything up to that expectation. So once we generate that SBOM, we take a look and see what the findings are. We look at what the components are. And then really, it's just a matter of keeping an eye on those components down the line and into the future. Those components may change as continuous development goes on for the device. So understanding when those components change, when they get updated, when a new one gets added in to replace an old one, things like that, and then having this SBOM continually update. As the life cycle of these components goes on, we'll be able to identify new vulnerabilities that come up, old vulnerabilities that were only recently discovered, and that helps guide decision for remediation.
Yeah, so as part of post-market, the SBOM is updated in real time if the product is updated, and all the third-party libraries that make up the SBOM are monitored in real time in case there's a vulnerability discovered, like the one we talked about with Bash, for instance. And then once something's discovered, we have to look at the risk to it and work with the manufacturer to get their device updated, which is often updating that third-party library, which might break something else. Or maybe the risk isn't that big a deal. Depends on, you know, the vulnerability discovered.
Yeah. One thing that is always the top priority in the SBOM is findings in the CISA known exploited vulnerabilities list. It's actually a pretty small percentage of CVEs, CVEs are going to be a known vulnerability in a specific device, component, library. Just if there's a product and there's a problem with it, it'll get assigned a CVE. The known exploited vulnerabilities list are essentially the worst of the CVEs. So these are CVEs that are known to be exploited and reproduced by threat actors. Most CVEs, well over 99% of them, have never actually been exploited by a threat actor that we know of. They're disclosed to the manufacturer by a security researcher that catches it first. So these CVEs that are publicly disclosed and are exploited by threat actors, these are really nasty, and usually less talented hackers or hackers just looking for the low-hanging fruit, anything they can get a hold on to try to attack, are going to target any CVEs they can find in that list and just spread it across the network to see where they get hits. So with that being such a common attack method, having a KEV finding in a medical device usually means that it's going to get hit by these wide-cast attacks that are trying to just target anything at random. So these are the top priority to make sure these are designed out as they're identified in the pre-market, but especially during the post-market if a finding gets promoted to a KEV or if they...
So you're saying like there could be a vulnerability that we're aware of and it's acceptable in pre-market, but then in post-market, some attacker could come up with an exploit that can take over that vulnerability, which changes the risk of that vulnerability, right? So that vulnerability is no longer like a low. It could turn into a critical if we can do a denial of service with this new exploit that is now publicly available.
Yeah, exactly. It's not likely that by just reading a security advisory for a component, an attacker is going to be able to engineer a custom exploit for it. It's very difficult work, and it's possible, but it's usually more work than it's worth in a situation like this. Attackers try to target low-hanging fruit, whatever they can do to get quick, easy access. It's about money. And so your return is not going to be as good if you have to spend 5 times the amount of time on trying to develop an exploit as opposed to just going for something you already have. So if an exploit is available and it gets publicized, a previous finding that wasn't a big deal before is now going to be used by thousands of attackers trying to grab onto whatever they can find. So then it's going to get promoted to a top priority issue.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that's required is a monitoring of that CISA KEV or known exploitable vulnerability database in case a new one pops up and that new one is applicable to the device. So that's part of post-market as well. And I want to take one step back to the SBOM and the resistance a lot of our clients have to making that public. What are your thoughts on that? Like, is the SBOM a playbook to attack their device or what is your thoughts?
I understand their concern on it, but I'll go back to your example about the car. You should know what's in whatever you're buying. When I buy this laptop that I have right in front of me, I know what the processor is. I know the graphics card. I know who makes the RAM, who makes the motherboard, who makes the screen. And it would seem weird and dishonest if I just bought a laptop. I said, oh, cool. Who makes these parts? They say, we're not going to tell you. It's a secret. That's weird. And so I wouldn't feel
then as a consumer, you might buy a different laptop where they actually tell you, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't have got this laptop if they wouldn't tell me what was inside of it. I would have gone to someone who is disclosing that information and selling me this laptop. And part of that is I can make an informed decision on if I see, oh, that component in that laptop has been known to break repeatedly or it's exposed to a certain vulnerability, then I might not want to buy that laptop. And so that's what I'm getting by someone not wanting to disclose what's inside their device. Customers are entitled to know what goes into their device and they should have easy access to that information. So going back to customer or manufacturer resistance around this, I do understand why they may be hesitant. The two main arguments that we get are, oh, isn't this giving attackers a path into the device? And the answer is no. An SBOM is hardly ever going to be enough of a problem for, or enough of a information for an attacker to hack into a device. If there are findings in, or if there are components in the SBOM that can let you hack into the device just by knowing the component is there, that component shouldn't be there in the first place. So it's a way of saying, yeah, we know our device is reasonably safe and we're willing to publicize the information proving it. The second argument that I hear is, well, isn't this giving direct information to our competitors on how our device was built? And the answer to that, again, is no. It would take definitely a really, really talented engineer to essentially reverse engineer a product off of an SBOM. I've personally never heard of it happening, and I don't think anyone else has. So it's not something that would be realistic from a concern. Knowing what compression library is used in your device or in your application is not sensitive information necessarily. It's not some big secret. Anyone can use any compression library. Any of these components, as long as you aren't just gluing together a bunch of components and hoping they run, the secret sauce is always going to be the code written by the manufacturer and what is produced.
Which is not disclosed in the SBOM.
Yeah, the content isn't. The fact that it's there is disclosed in the SBOM. So it's saying that there is this, yeah, all of this code written by X company here. What it isn't saying is what that source code is. And that's the sensitive information right there.
Okay, awesome. I think we covered SBOM pretty good. I want to cover a couple other things before we wrap up. One is anomalies, because I know in pre-market, there are software anomalies or bugs that may not have a cybersecurity concern with it, but there's also some cybersecurity anomalies. In your experience, how are these anomalies impacted on post-market, or what's the impact of these anomalies on post-market or in post-market?
So there are two parts. There are the anomalies themselves and the detection and evaluation of anomalies. The anomalies themselves, that's strange behavior in software that is not designed out. This may or may not have a cybersecurity impact, and that's a pre-market requirement, is to determine what does have a cybersecurity impact. Moving into the post-market, the requirement is to have a way to identify and evaluate these findings in the future to determine if they have a cybersecurity impact. Very often they will. So very often an anomaly can just be some strange part of the code, some weird behavior, and it introduces a vulnerability into the system. Very often there can be no impact. The device just does something weird under some certain situation, but it's just odd behavior. It's not anything that could potentially harm a patient or disclose patient information. So a way to identify strange behavior in the device through verification and validation testing, and then understand what the scope of that is very important for device manufacturers early and then throughout the life cycle.
Excellent. And one of the other requirements for post-market is penetration testing. I get this question quite a bit. People are like, you already tested our product and it's on the market. Why do you need to test it 6 months later? What is your answer to that question?
Devices can change. We'll look at what we were talking about earlier with the KEV for sort of an easy example. A problem in the device can get upgraded to a bigger problem as time goes on. Security research is a constantly evolving field. There are vulnerabilities in protocols that have been around for 10, 15 years that are only being discovered in the past year or two. So cybersecurity is super dynamic. It changes all the time. To stay on top of that, it's important to continually test the system as new things pop up, new attack techniques pop up, new vulnerabilities in, say, Bluetooth, an extremely common protocol used in tons of devices, may be discovered, and then it needs to be verified whether or not that's present in the system. So as with anything in security, penetration testing can't be a one-and-done process. It has to be continuous and it has to be iterative to make sure that you're catching everything throughout the lifecycle of a product.
Why is there this resistance to anything continuous in cybersecurity? Everybody wants it to be one and done.
Well,
or is that just human nature? That might just be human nature. I don't know.
It's human nature, but
cybersecurity. I want to lift weights one time and become stronger, right? I don't want to have to continuously do it, right?
Wouldn't that be the dream? They got to invent a pill for that. They have Ozempic to make you thin. Now they need to make a pill to make you bigger. So that's the $1 billion idea right there.
Well, they have that. It's called McDonald's.
No, good bigger, not bad bigger.
Okay.
I guess they call those steroids, so, you
know. Right.
With cybersecurity in general, I always refer to it as the necessary evil of the tech field. Nobody wants to spend money on cybersecurity since it's expensive and it doesn't provide any value. Spending money on research, design, marketing, sales, that's fine. That has a return. Cybersecurity only costs money. There is no return from it. The only benefit is that you are passing some compliance check or a regulatory check. So that is the typical perception. As public interest in cybersecurity is increasing, now hospitals and consumers, they won't buy an insecure device without this information. So it's a bit of a misconception, but that is the view that most manufacturers and companies take. So now when you tell them you have to allocate a chunk of your budget every single year to this process that you didn't even want to do once, people don't like that.
Well, it's like going to the dentist. I think you said it once. It's a necessary evil.
It's like going to the dentist. You have to go.
Yeah. And it costs money that you don't want to spend to see the dentist. Awesome. I think we're coming up on time here. Any parting thoughts on post-market surveillance or post-market management?
I think that we covered just about everything. You know, of course, post-market and cybersecurity in general is a mile wide and a mile deep, but it's a good way to start wrapping your head around what can happen after the fact.
Awesome. Well, thanks for tuning in to the MedDevice Cyber Podcast. We'll wrap up here. In the next episode, we're going to cover interoperability issues with third-party components. So stay tuned.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the MedDevice Cyber Podcast. We hope you gained valuable insights into the world of medical device cybersecurity. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast on your favorite platform. Should cybersecurity be top of mind for your medical device company and you wish to learn more about how Blue Goat Cyber can help your business, please click on the link in the show notes below to book a discovery call with our team. Stay informed and empowered to protect yourself and the people your company serves. Until next time, stay safe and secure.